welcome to the Friendly Atheist Podcast. This is Jess. I am here with Dr. Nikki Hemmer, and I am just over the moon to have her here, so much so that I forgot how you start podcasts. Dr. Hemmer, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm so happy to be here.
I listened to Dr. Hemmer's podcast, This Day in Esoteric Political History, which genuinely I think is as good a history podcast as out there. I'm obsessed with it. And Dr. Hemmer, you study, let me see if I can get this right, 20th century post-World War II conservative politics / the presidency?
That is right. It's kind of a, you know, 20th century politics. I run a center for the presidency at Vanderbilt. So that's a specialty of mine. And yeah, just like all this stuff that's happening in the 20th century around the right. And now kind of leaking a little bit into the 21st century. It is a never-ending font of material for analysis. Yeah.
How did you find your way into this kind of niche thing? It sounds like a deeply upsetting thing to study all the time.
I didn't realize when I was getting into it that it was going to be quite so upsetting. I had actually gone to graduate school to study sort of late 19th, early 20th century intellectual history. And I got to graduate school. I was a first generation college student, so I was flying by the seat of my pants. And the first summer after my first year of graduate school, I went home and I was hanging out with my dad, who's pretty conservative. And he and I were driving around and he was like, my goal for you this summer, because it was 2004, he was like, my goal for you this summer is to get you to vote for George W. Bush.
Oh, boy.
And yeah. And he reaches over and he turns on the radio to the Rush Limbaugh
show. No.
Yes. And for me, I was, it did not change my politics, but I spent that summer listening to right-wing talk radio with my dad and seeing not only what was on those shows, but seeing how my dad interacted with it, the way that he was kind of in conversation with these hosts. He would sometimes like go along with their arguments. He would sometimes do like a an ad absurdum argument and then back away. Like there was all of this interplay happening. And I thought it was so interesting that he thought, if I listen to the Rush Limbaugh show, my politics will change. And that got me super interested in right-wing radio. I stumbled onto a kind of history of it from the 1950s and 60s. That's what I ended up writing my dissertation about. And the rest, as they say,
That's
is history.
Absolutely incredible. Well, and you're from Indiana, right?
I am from Indiana. I'm from Southern Indiana.
Whereabouts?
I'm from Evansville originally.
Oh my God. That's why I went to school in Muncie. So like half of my friends were from like that area. My best friend lives in Louisville. So I'm always in that kind of Southern Indiana area. Lots of Trump signs.
I saw a look of recognition. Lots of Trump signs. You know, actually, it's interesting because the district I grew up in was known as the Fighting Eighth. I think every state has its fighting district. So Evansville was a city, tended to skew a little bluer, but it was surrounded by a ring of incredibly red rural counties. I lived out in one of those counties. And it made the congressional district fights really fierce between, you know, sort of moderate Democrats and some of the furthest right conservative Republicans, including a Republican named John Hostetler, who really what he was like the you'd have these votes that were like 450-1 or something. And he would always be like the one kind of outlier.
So I'm a horseback riding instructor. And so I work with a lot of teenage girls who are always telling me how bored they are. And so I lecture them about various things I think about. And my one student who's 14, she had to write a paper that she had a strong opinion, like an opinion paper. And she's like, I don't have an opinion. So I was like, good news, made of opinions. I gave her a very long list of like things she should write about, all of which were deeply boring and over her head and stupid. And for some reason, the one thing she glommed onto is that I said that Ronald Reagan is realistically responsible for a lot of issues that we see in present day society. And the only thing she's gotten out of that so far is that I hate Ronald Reagan, which is not untrue, but not necessarily helpful. And then she asked me a question that I want to ask you. Do you have a favorite president? Because I was kind of, she asked me that and I was like, well, I don't know, because FDR, you know, the New Deal, great. Japanese internment, worse. Like,
They tend to be mixed bags.
Like,
yeah.
Lincoln, of course, freed slaves, yada, yada, yada. But, like, that his goal wasn't to free the slave. Like, he wanted to preserve the Union first and foremost, right? Is that a fair assessment of that?
It is a fair assessment. His goals changed over the course of the war. And I think that given the times in which he was operating, the political constraints, the war going on, was he, like, the perfect avatar of, like, racial justice and pure multiracial democracy? Probably not. But probably as good as the U.S. would have gotten at that time. And you can see that in contrast to who comes after him.
So with that in mind, do you have a favorite?
Oh, this is such a hard question because there's favorite, like, most admirable, and people like Lincoln. Sure. I mean, Lincoln has to, like, be at or very near the top of that list. Then there are people who you, like, admire as people, like Jimmy Carter, but who actually weren't great as members of the executive. So he wasn't, like, a great president. And then for me, there are just, like, the interesting presidents. And that's where I tend to gravitate. So it's less favorite presidents, but, like, the people I really like thinking about and writing about. Unsurprisingly, those tend to be 20th century presidents. I have spent a lot of time working on Richard Nixon, my last book dealt with Ronald Reagan some. I find him less interesting as a president because he's kind of like
a puppet.
He feels very straightforward, if you know what I mean.
Oh, okay.
That's not how he's normally written about. I feel like all of his biographers are like, he's impossible to pin down. But I don't find him as interestingly complex as someone like Nixon or Bill Clinton, who I just find, because they're not great people, I find them super interesting in the way that they ultimately govern. So this is a very, like, non-straightforward answer to your question.
It feels a little bit like sort of the true crime thing of, like, oh, what's your favorite murder? And it's like, I don't like it. It's just, this is the one that's stuck in my head.
That's exactly, like, who are you obsessed
with? Exactly.
When it comes to presidents, like, I am obsessed with Richard Nixon, with Bill Clinton, and also with Barack Obama. I spent the last 3 years before moving to Nashville working on the Obama Presidency Oral History Project. So I was steeped in Obama land for all of that time. I got to interview him earlier this spring. And so he's always going to have a special place in my heart. I've taught a class on his presidency. And also just like, it's one of those presidencies I don't think we're going to get our arms around for a very long time, because you have Bush and Trump on either side. And if you're trying to make sense of, like, what happened to the U.S., they are going to attract much more attention. And then you have Biden coming after, who has managed to enact a much more liberal left agenda than Barack Obama was able to. I mean, the Democratic Party is very different now. And so I just have no idea how we're going to assess him 20, 30, 40 years from now.
Yeah, going back to the Nixon thing, I've watched that the Watergate docuseries that you're in. I cannot think of the name.
Slow Burn.
First of all, I like it so much.
It's so good.
I got so deep into Watergate last year, as I think a lot of people did. And I also, so I got really deep into, like, FBI stuff in the last year. And so somebody who's been coming up onto my radar a lot is J. Edgar Hoover, who is there a more influential person in the 20th century, would you say?
No, there's that new biography out by Bev Gage called G-Man, which is a biography of J. Edgar Hoover. She's been working on it for 20 years. It finally comes out. It's 1,000 pages long, and she cut so much from this book in the process of finally publishing it. It wins the Pulitzer Prize. It wins every history prize out there. And it has the subtitle, I think it's something like J. Edgar Hoover and the American Century. And that kind of subtitle, like the name and the American century, is so hackneyed. No book ever lives up to it because nobody actually ever exemplifies the American century. But you know what? J. Edgar Hoover earns it. He is there in a seat of power from like the early 20s to the 70s. He's everywhere, and he shapes American power and the presidency and the national government and people's daily mm-hmm. lives in such profound ways that
it's,
yes, he is a maker of the American century.
It truly, I read an autobiography about John Douglas, and I did not realize there had been female FBI agents predating Hoover. And he was like, absolutely yeah. not, out with you, which is, I mean, not surprising, of course. I guess I'm more surprised that they were able to go back so hard so quickly just off his sheer mm-hmm. force of personality.
One of the things that I love about that, I mean, I obviously don't mm-hmm. love that women were excluded from the FBI, but, you know, we have these stories that we tell ourselves about history, about how progress is inevitable, mm-hmm. that rights once gained will stay gained. Mm-hmm. And that's just like this one little anecdote about, oh, did you know there were women FBI agents? And then they were like, no, we're not going to yeah. do that. And that is kind of, as you sort of begin to rifle through some of U.S. mm-hmm. history, you see people gaining opportunities, you see people gaining rights and then being systematically shut out. And women FBI agents were among those.
It's just so baffling. And how, like, the name J. Edgar Hoover is so ubiquitous, right? Like, I heard mm-hmm. it when I was 5 years old watching Clue a billion times as a kid, right? Like, J. Edgar, why is J. Edgar Hoover on your phone?
J. Edgar Hoover.
And so he was just sort of this, like, floating, like, guy above everything. Mm-hmm. And I read a book about Bellevue, the hospital in New York. And he mm-hmm. was talking a lot about 20th century, and the author made a note that Hoover's idea with G-Men was that he wanted them to be painted as basically superheroes, hence like the kind of G-Man thing, so they would be able to do whatever the fuck they wanted. Is that basically it?
Yeah.
I mean,
yes, that you could act without constraints, which is something that Hoover was. It's so fascinating the way that the avatars of Law and Order are actually operating in the most lawless ways. And Hoover is an excellent example of this. You know, the idea that the FBI was untouchable. Mm-hmm. And it's telling that it's not until after Hoover mm-hmm. dies that you get that big exploration by Senator Frank Church into the CIA and into the intelligence communities to say, oh, these were actually super corrupt and operating unconstitutionally and illegally.
And the Cold War was such a driver of everything in the 20th century. And I mm-hmm. am the first to admit I do not understand it. And I'm trying. But I have a thought that I want to run by you, that World War II mm-hmm. was this like moment of Americana in that everybody's pitching in victory gardens, don't wear your pantyhose, you know, Rosie the Riveter, etc. And it was, we got to fight the Nazis. We got to fight Hitler. It's a Hitler. It's the Hitler. And it was a, it's a war people love to remember because there is a good guy and a bad guy. Mm-hmm. Has the American government been trying to recast Nazis for the rest of the 20th century? Like, I feel like they went to communism. Ah, communism's the big scare. But, like, that doesn't mean anything to me as a human being. I don't, like, Nazis are scary. They're murdering people. Communism is like, you're threatening with bread lines, but I don't, that's not in my my understanding. Do you think that's accurate?
It's so much more amorphous. Yeah. I mean, you're on to two really important things. And one is that World War II is, quote unquote, the yeah. good war, right? Where it was so clear who the good guys were and who the bad guys were, and we're fighting the Nazis. And there's something so comforting about this idea that we are just on the right side. And that also helps to paper over the fact that it's, we talked about this on this day, that it's during World War II that napalm is invented. Obviously, it's during World War II that the atomic yeah. weapons are first unleashed on the world. These are terrible, terrible things. You've mentioned Japanese mm-hmm. internment. It wasn't so clear-cut, good guys and bad guys, but that is the story that we tell ourselves. Communism really was more amorphous. I do think that the fear of the Soviets and communism, especially in the 1950s and 1960s, was so intense in the United States. I think it's difficult to recapture how afraid many people were. And they were afraid in large part because of nuclear weapons, mm-hmm. right? Like, there's something so destabilizing about this new weapon that it's not just that it has the power to wipe out all life on Earth, although that's a big part of it, but there's something kind of mystical and terrifying about the idea that we've unleashed the power of the atom, the building block of life, and the it's so destabilizing. Power of the sun. And there was something like at the time that people were really excited about it. They were like, oh, we could have unlimited power. This is incredible. If we can just continue to harness the power of the atom. But it was also destabilizing because it was like, and we can also wipe out all life on Earth. And the Soviets come to represent once they get the bomb, which is very shortly after World War II. They represent a kind of existential threat in a way that no other war had really ever represented. And I think that's why it comes to captivate people so much. And of course, it lasts for 40 years and it goes terribly awry. But that was the fuel for
it. Well, and the idea is that they wanted... My understanding of the reason that they were building, a lot of people building this bomb said, this is a bomb that's going to end wars. Once we have this bomb, everyone will be like, okay, we can't fight wars anymore. Because we've got these bombs. Like, do you think they must have really believed that, do you think, in their hearts?
I think there were some people who absolutely believed that. I'll tag another episode of this day that we did. So when airplanes were first invented, Orville and Wilbur Wright really did believe that because airplanes would fundamentally change the nature of war, they would make it possible to see from very high up where troops were approaching from, that they would actually be instruments of peace. That you would be able to eliminate war because you had this new kind of almost defensive weapon. And there absolutely were people who believed that. It's an incredibly naive belief in a lot of ways. I mean, the very idea that you can end all war strikes me as both... I love that people believe that. It seems extremely unrealistic and historically ahistoric in a lot of ways, right? Like,
I mean, as long as there's...
Good luck. It's been with us
as long as there's any kind of imbalance of power, right? There's going to be conflict.
Absolutely. And there will be... It's interesting how the dawn of the atomic age played out. There hasn't been the use of nuclear weapons ever since. And so there is something that happens with... nuclear weapons that once they have been used, they continue to exist as this tremendous threat, but they don't get used again. They change, you know, we get all of these proxy wars during the Cold War to keep both sides from using nuclear weapons. So that's interesting, but it's not an end to war.
And then the Cold War and the space race are sort of always going to be hand in hand. And that's another, I think. I was like, where did I just hear that? It's literally your podcast. I'm halfway through it. The one about the station crashing, the orbiting, what was that called? The Skylab? Skylab crashing down. And you did such a wonderful job of summing up 1969 to 1979 in terms of trust in American politics and things like that. Could you kind of explain that a little bit for me? I just really enjoyed hearing you talk about it.
Sure. I could talk about space all day. This is actually something that I'm mildly obsessed with. But, you know, the 60s were very much defined, yes, by the space race, but by this very optimistic goal that John Kennedy lays out at the beginning of his presidency, that a man will walk on the moon by the end of the decade, which seems like incredibly unrealistic. And yet, you know, a man goes into orbit shortly thereafter, and there are all these successive ventures. And ultimately, in 1969, the U.S. lands people on the moon. And it is this moment of awe and accomplishment and a kind of optimistic hope that you can dream big dreams and you can achieve them. Not to say that, like, the space program wasn't controversial, but it was this moment that seemed to summarize the feeling of the 60s, that big government could do big things and make the world wider and more possible in some ways. The 1970s, not a great decade for government. And it's in 1979 that Skylab, which was this space station that was supposed to stay in orbit for, like, 10, 12 years, its orbit started to decay fairly quickly, and it was clear that it was going to come crashing back down to Earth, and nobody knew how to stop it from potentially crashing into, like,
New York City.
New York City. Beijing, London. Like, what happens when a space station crashes down on a
because
major
NASA
city?
Had not put any kind of way to control it, period. End of sentence.
there's a saying, right? What comes up must, what goes up must come down. And that very basic lesson seemed to be something that NASA had not learned. Yeah, so there was no way to control it. So it's just degrading in space, and NASA can't come up with a plan, and the government can't come up with a plan, and ultimately it crashes in the Indian Ocean. Nobody is harmed by the crash. A few pieces wash up in Australia. But that idea that, like, here you've tried to do something big in space, and it all comes crashing down at the end of the 70s, and it is kind of like that malaise decade where, like, nothing works. Government doesn't work. Nothing. There's nothing to hope in anymore. And that becomes symbolic of how, I don't know, just how sad and desperate that decade was.
And do you think that sort of feeling of malaise paved the way for a Reagan to come through and just be like, hey, better times ahead?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, Reagan, it's hard to remember this now, but he was somebody who was so charismatic. He was an actor. He comes in with a bold message, make America great again, as
that
well as
familiar. I've never heard that before.
Yeah, isn't that an interesting, I'm glad we've been able to recover that from 40 years ago. but this idea that it comes out in his 84 campaign, that it's morning again in America. That America can stand strong in the world again. It's coming not only after the Carter administration, which had kind of flopped to an end. There was a hostage crisis that was going that made the U.S. look weak in the world. There had been gas rationing, which made it seem like the days of abundance were over. The Vietnam War had ended, and then the South Vietnamese resistance had fallen. And it just seemed like everything was failing. And that that American power was dying out, and that America's best days were behind it. And Reagan comes up and he's like, no, America's best days are ahead of it. And as simple as that message is, and as little as backed it up, that was a promise that people were like, ugh, I would like to believe that.
Yeah.
And he wins two massive landslide
elections. Just wild. That makes me think a lot about, I remember when I was young, my dad, who was a Republican until Trump, he hates Trump, and he, like, phone banked for Biden in 2020. Like, he,
incredible.
It's wild stuff. But I remember when he was younger, or when I was younger, rather, I guess we were both younger, that's how time works. He had said something in passing about, like, how did the flower children of the 60s become these, like, shitty, racist, hateful adults? And I feel like maybe you're helping me understand that a little bit more of they grew up with the promise of this. I mean, Lord, if I had gotten rich, that would be the path I went down too, right? Like, I graduated college in 2008, the market was garbage.
Yep.
I had no faith in anything. And if I now was wealthy, I could see myself being more conservative. But unfortunately, but I guess that's what happened, right? They got disillusioned in the 70s. Things were terrible. Watergate happened, destroyed U.S. confidence in its government in a huge way. And then, what, Ronald Reagan comes out and says, what, it's okay to be American again or something.
Yeah, he says, you know, we're going to take the fight to the people out there. I mean, he doesn't actually end up doing that.
He does nothing.
He has the invasion of Grenada. But then, you know, he promises to end the Cold War, and the Cold War does end at the end of the 1980s. There is a growing prosperity with an asterisk. So there were some efforts being undertaken with monetary policy under Carter in the last few years he was in office that were already beginning to break the back of inflation. So that was the other thing about the 70s inflation. Was you think inflation is bad now? It was really bad then. And not only was like inflation really bad, but the unemployment rate was going up. And so everyone was immiserated by the economy. And a lot of that gets shaken out in the 1980s. Now, the cost of Reaganomics, of Reagan's approach to the economy and to this new era after the 1970s, was that inequality almost immediately begins to spike. There's a kind of my colleague Jeff Cowie talks about the New Deal era in the 1940s and 1950s as the great exception, this period in which inequality was flattened. There was more widely shared prosperity. There was a government willing to work to protect, eventually, the civil rights and rights of Black Americans and women and gay people and across the board. And that is something that is given up on in the 1980s. This idea of widely shared prosperity, multiracial democracy, that begins to fade away, especially among Republicans, as their vision. Now, Reagan still embraces ideas of diversity. He's open to immigration. He's very much invested in the language of freedom. It's not until the 90s that really begins to turn and spoil on the right. But Reagan sets into motion the breakdown of sort of welfare policies, shared equality. It's a decade of greed and the rich getting richer more than it is a decade where the middle class is on the rise.
I feel like when I found out that Nixon passed the EPA, my head almost fell clean off my shoulders. I just couldn't wrap my head around it because that's nothing you would see today. But like you said, Reagan wasn't as socially conservative as we are today. He was just extremely fiscally conservative, right? Is that a correct assessment?
I mean, that's true, certainly for his personal politics. Reagan would end up offering a lot to the religious right and to social conservatives, but he himself was more libertine and more of a libertarian than he was a social conservative.
I see.
I'll talk about some caveats to that in a second, but he was, you know, in the late 1970s, when there are all of these pushes across the country to make it possible to fire gay people from their jobs for being gay. Reagan says, no, well, that's a bad idea. That's encroaching on people's civil rights. So that makes him a little different from the religious right that he's courting in the 1980s. At the same time, Ronald Reagan becomes the first president to write and publish a book while in office, and that book was called Abortion and the Conscience of a Nation. So a very strong anti-abortion book. Yeah. So, and he's also—
I did not know that.
Yeah.
Yikes. Say it again. Abortion and the Conscience of America?
Abortion and the Conscience. The Conscience of a Nation. Yeah. I mean, so he doesn't deliver anti-abortion policy necessarily, but he does continue to support the anti-abortion movement.
Sets the table for sure for other people to take it a step further.
Absolutely. It's in the early 80s when the Federalist Society is founded. You can begin to see how those things are related. And also, like, Reagan gives a campaign speech in Philadelphia, Mississippi, where he talks about states' rights, which is a big dog whistle for segregationists and for anti-Black Americans. And so to say that he doesn't have any sort of social or racial conservatism isn't quite right, but he's definitely different than what comes after. Like, the Republican Party is marching to the right in the 70s and 80s and 90s and beyond. And so somebody who was pretty conservative in the 70s and 80s, we're now looking back at it and we're like, well, we weren't that conservative. Then try to overthrow the
government. Like, okay, so let's, since this is called The Friendly Atheist and the premises I'm supposed to be talking about religion, and not just interview people I want to talk to, which is what I do. I want to talk about the Christian right in the 20th century. I just bought a book and I was like, oh, I should read it before I interview Dr. Hammer. But that was like yesterday, Jesus and John Wayne. I'm very, very, very excited to read it. I would love to sort of talk about how Christianity became ubiquitous with conservative politics, and how that looped into what I really would love to hear you explain to me is the party's flipping platforms, and like we kind of understand if we study is history. Like, we see that it happens over however long, but like an election, what does it look like when two parties are completely flipping their policies? Like, what was this sort of like madness that was happening in the 5 years or the decade that was flipping?
So the flip takes a lot longer than that. I mean, the way that it's usually described is a flip that happens in 1964. It happens almost immediately because Lyndon Johnson signs the Civil Rights Act. There's this apocryphal story that he says, "I've signed away the South for a generation." Mm. Actually, it seemed they signed away the South for much longer, certainly the White South. Sure. But, you know, Bill Clinton, even in the 1990s, is winning states like Arkansas and some of these Deep South states. When he runs. So there is, it takes a while.
God, yeah, I guess it's through our lifetime. That's weird.
It really is. I mean, you see it in these border states like Tennessee, where I live now, in Kentucky, where at least at the state level, they had a strong Democratic Party until very recently, until the past 10 or 15 years. So it's a slower process. But I think it is incomplete when we talk about it solely in terms of the Republican Party beginning to embrace anti-Black policies. Okay. That is a huge part of it. But I think it's important to bring religion in, too, because part of the shift that is happening is around religion. The Republican Party in the first half of the 20th century was a party of white Protestants. And when it came to religious social policy, they weren't necessarily pushing it that hard, which is not to say that, I mean, there certainly were right-wing Christian nationalists who had power in both parties and who were pushing religious policies. But the party as a whole, like the Republican Party is the first to come out for the Equal Rights Amendment, for the equal rights of women in the United States. They are the party of Planned Parenthood. Barry Goldwater, a very conservative senator who wins the Republican nomination in 1964, his wife was a co-founder of the Phoenix branch of Planned Parenthood.
Wow.
Yeah. So, I mean, there the idea that reproductive rights were something that the Democratic Party supported just wasn't the case. One more example, George H.W. Bush, who, of course, becomes vice president under Reagan and then president after, was a Republican member of Congress, and he was so pro-reproductive rights that they called him Robert.
What? Okay, now in my head in the White House, there's just like a bowl of condoms, like in your
just
RAs.
A bowl of condoms, right? You think about it with Clinton, sure, but it was actually George H.W. Bush that was putting him out there. And so he has to give up his pro-reproductive rights policies in order to get on the ticket with Reagan. And that gives you a sense of how things are shifting, that the party is shifting as it begins to embrace both the evangelical religious right and as it tries to peel Catholics off from the Democratic Party.
Yeah, I feel like my relationship with Catholicism is very strange because I grew up in the Chicagoland area, the child of two lapsed Catholics. Everybody I knew was Catholic. Like, I did not realize that Catholicism and Christianity were not the same thing until I was in college. Like, that was just the way I grew up. And everybody I knew growing up, especially if they were, like, very religious, were very conservative. So this idea of Catholics being an other is such a wild thing. It took me so long to wrap my mind around the fact that, like, JFK was, like, a Catholic, and that was red flags for people. I think our short memory of history is one of the reasons we're so racist all the time. It's like, dude, like, I'm half Italian. A century ago, I was not white. Like, that's not, that's, there was an amazing episode about Judaism and how Jewish people claimed their identity and became quote unquote white because they were not. Like, it's these ways that we think of the Irish, golly, like the ways we think about these things. But it's like, no, this time they're actually bad. You're confused. The last time we were confused, this time they're really bad. Like,
right. It doesn't make people rethink the entire system of othering and racism. It just reshuffles again and again. And I think that, you know, one of the reasons that the Italians and Irish were not considered white was their Catholicism, right? That it was part of their otherness that comes into play. But that anti-Catholic sentiment in the United States was wild.
So
in the 19th
strange.
Into the 20th century, the Klan, in fact,
was
quite anti-Catholic in the 1920s.
Which is, I think I learned that fact on your podcast and just like could not function for like an hour. I was like, wait, like it truly is. I think our understanding of history becomes so simplified that when we lose nuances, we lose really important understandings of how the world works. And the fact that I didn't know that the KKK was anti-Catholic, that would have changed how I viewed them. Because, like, I was a white, you know, a white person. I was not worried about the KKK in so much, even when I was in Indiana. But if I had known they were anti-Catholic, that would have painted a more interesting and nuanced picture of a group of scared white guys who were just going after everybody mm-hmm. who was not them.
And how racism and bigotry functions, like what it functions for, that it is not a sort of like natural response to black people, which I think is sometimes how like,
yeah,
people, even well-meaning people, think of it, that there's something sort of natural about it. And if you can see these kind of, this kind of broader scope of prejudice and how it, you know, ebbs and flows over the decades and centuries, I think it helps. And you can also begin to see connections. Because there was a women's auxiliary to the Ku Klux Klan
cool.
in the 20s.
Glad they're diverse.
And, right? You know, they're very modern in that way. But that women's auxiliary, the WKKK, was focused on purging Catholic school teachers, so getting them fired, getting any sort of Catholic books banned from school libraries. And you hear that and you're like, book bans?
That sounds
teachers
familiar.
Getting fired. If we look and see like these trends, first of all, that they're associated with some pretty not mm-hmm. great things, that they're associated with political illiberalism and with violence again and again and mm-hmm. again in U.S. history, we could be a little less shocked when Moms for Liberty roll around and start banning uh-huh. books and getting teachers fired and start associating with violent groups and quoting mm-hmm. Hitler. And then you're like, oh, I get how this
yeah.
connects. And we can get over our surprise a little more quickly so that we can act a little
more quickly.
I
mean, we just covered a story that I have just been thinking about so much, of a teacher or a principal or somebody got fired because a teacher showed her students a picture of the Statue of David.
Mm-hmm.
And the principal got fired or something.
Yes.
Like, it's so... like, how can you get so swept up in the, I mean, I guess it's cults too, right? Like you just in a feedback loop and everybody just, it's wild.
I think it is wild. And I think that it's important not to get too hung up on the inconsistencies, because you could look at something like that and you could be like, wait, these are the same people who are like Western
yeah,
Civ,
yeah.
Western Civ, and it's the Statue of David. What are you doing? But if you think about it in terms of the moral panic over so-called grooming and over sexuality and over schools and a desire to exert control and to show that you have this control in order to keep everyone else in line, then maybe you sacrifice a teacher and a picture of David in order to fulfill this larger political
goal.
Oh my
God, it's insane. What is your favorite moral panic of the 20th century?
There are so many. I mean, I am still pretty fascinated by the satanic panic of the
80s. It's such an obvious answer.
It's hard not
but,
to,
like,
yeah, I know.
It was,
but,
oof.
Because it has, like, because the occult is so interesting, I think that's what draws me to it. But also, you know, it is bound up in the sort of child abduction mm-hmm. panic and the child sexual abuse panic. And the thing that interests me so much about it is that at that very moment, we suddenly had new information about, like, oh, like, children are more likely to be abused by people that they know. They're more likely to be abducted by people that they know. And we have this whole decade or two of stranger
mm-hmm.
danger that then distracts from this very real issue that society could have been dealing with and facing. You know, it takes another 20 years for the church sexual abuse scandals to break. And all of it, like, it has such a high cost. Like, it's not just that it's these, that people actually believe these wild stories about Satanists, but that there's also a deep political and cultural and just like personal cost for so many people. That makes it really fascinating. But I mean, the 20th century is just awash in moral panics. It's basically the leitmotif of politics.
And why do you think that is? Like, have moral panics been happening just all through time, and it just mass media made it a little more accessible and larger?
I mean, moral panics have definitely been around for a long time. Think about the witch trials of the 16th and 17th century.
Like, I went to Salem in 2019 for a friend's wedding, and I loved it. I love history. I love walking around. But there was a really weird vibe that I kept thinking, like 19 people died, gang. Like, I don't know if your sparkly witch's hat is, like, chill. But that's really me being judgy. Yeah. And
It's you being judgy, and like, but not necessarily wrong. I mean, there was when I was in graduate school, I was in graduate school with a really wonderful historian who worked on, among many things, women's history. And I remember her coming in sort of like steam rolling out of her ears one day, because there had been all of these like cutesy statues that were going up around the country that were associated with like television shows. And in Salem, they had just put up a statue from Bewitched. And she was like, I mean, congratulations on your TV show about witches, but women were murdered there because they were women. And that's not something that we should be like being doing a little nose wrinkle and a little wink about. Yeah. So, I mean, I think that there's space. I think that there's space for all of these things. But it's okay to also have some moments of introspection to say, are we cutesifying this a little bit too much? Because if we saw it as the act of terrorism and violence that it actually was, we might think about it a little differently.
Yeah, and I will say, like, they do have a museum that walks you through it in a really visceral, like, way. In a they're not trying to downplay it. They are telling you, like, yeah, my dude got smooshed to death, and his last words were more weight. Like, this shit was intense. Intense. But then it was
torture. Literal torture. Right?
Anyway, I don't remember where I was going with that. Could we talk a little bit about, you mentioned it quickly, abortion throughout the 20th century and how that has become a religious issue? Because pre-20th century, it was not even on the radar. Is that right? Like, it's just as long as there have been humans getting pregnant, there have been humans trying not get pregnant and not be pregnant anymore.
Absolutely. I mean, the efforts to end a pregnancy are simply part of medical history as long as we've had medical history. Now, it has not always been part of the formal patriarchal official medical system, but it is something that in particular women doctors and nurses and midwives have known about and have worked on across cultures and in the U.S. from the moment the U.S. was founded and well before. Abortion starts to kind of become part of politics during the late 19th century as the Comstock laws are being passed. So it's tied up in all of that vice regulation, which is to say, you know, it's when you start to get bans on information about sex and about birth control.
Sure.
It's tied up in this greater attack on reproductive knowledge and reproductive rights, which isn't to say that, like, it's, you know, it doesn't get banned wholesale across the country, but there are new limits being put on it. And doctors really push back against this as the medical profession professionalizes. they make the claim that, you know, actually, this should be the purview of doctors, not of lawmakers. Hmm. So you have activists throughout the 20th century who are trying to make reproductive rights more accessible, reproductive knowledge more accessible. But the modern abortion wars that we're used to thinking about really do emerge in the 60s and 70s. Catholics had been on the anti-abortion hop for a long time, and they are, in many ways, the entering wedge of this. They bring it into Protestantism. Mm-hmm. Where it largely hadn't been. They bring it into Judaism, where it largely hadn't been. Yeah, they are the sort of early adopters of anti-abortion politics, and are working at the same time that abortion laws are liberalizing in the 1960s. They are part of the movement constantly pushing back to try to keep abortion laws from becoming more liberalized. 1973, you have Roe v. Wade. It's obviously the beginning of this particular judicial battle that we've seen over the past 50 years now. And at that moment, like, even the conservative movement was not anti-abortion. Abortion was not an issue for evangelicals. It was not an issue for Republicans. It was not an issue for conservatives. As I said before, the Republican Party was the reproductive rights party. Protestants saw abortion as a Catholic issue. And conservatives were divided on it. There's this conservative talk radio host that I write about in my first book who was Catholic. And he came out pretty hard against abortion in the early 1970s. And one of his donors writes him and is like, this is not conservative. Wow. It is not conservative to have the government tell you what medical procedures you can have. You need to stop talking about this.
And did he?
And
no!
He does. Yes. He really needed the money.
Wow. People used to listen to criticism and take it into account. Imagine.
When the critics were signing the checks, it made it much easier to listen.
He still wouldn't have listened to me.
That I can guarantee. but then, like, the politics of abortion really do change after that. So I also come from a Catholic family. My mom had been at the convent prior to leaving and meeting my dad. So a very Catholic family, but anti-abortion culture was not a big part of my mom's upbringing, even though she was Catholic. Like, there wasn't, like, this idea that you have, like, little fetal pins, you know, the footprint pins. I wore those throughout high school. The T-shirts, like the kitsch, the tchotchkes, the anti-abortion tchotchkes.
Choose life, George Michael.
Culture. It's non-existent until the late 80s and the 90s. And so when I'm coming up as a Catholic, anti-abortion politics are all over the place. The idea that you would go to the March for Life every year in Washington, D.C., this was kind of like a rite of passage. And it's in the 80s and 90s that this begins to change, maybe the late 70s. The Southern Baptist Convention has to change its policy on abortion, I think maybe in the late 70s. It takes a long time for conservative Catholics and Protestants and Mormons and Jews to get on the same page about abortion. Even as evangelicals become more anti-abortion, there is still kind of this prejudice that keeps them from working with Catholics for a pretty long time. But the injection of all of this religion into politics, the rise of the moral majority and the religious right, and the idea, the fact that they make abortion their issue, the demand for an amendment outlawing abortion, overturning Roe v. Wade, the demand for judges who will overturn Roe v. Wade, that reshapes Republican politics by the 1980s.
Why do you think abortion was such a successful campaign platform? Because I've read, there's a quote I feel like everybody passes around of, the unborn are a really easy population to advocate for because they don't require anything of you. You don't have to feed them or clothe them or provide them with care. Do you think that's fair?
I think that the abortion issue is such a powerful one because, you know, how we were talking about World War II earlier? It is so easy if you believe that abortion stops a beating heart, that abortion is murder, for it to be, it's slot into such an easy moral story. And you combine that with control over women's reproductive rights, right? The patriarchy and misogyny inherent in opposition to women's reproductive rights. And it's very easy to supercharge it because you have very religious people who see it as as murder. You see other folks who see it as a kind of anti-feminist politics that they can then make a coalition around with religious voters. I think that's a big part of it. And politicians see it, I think they see it as kind of easy because they can't overturn Roe v. Wade. They know they're never going to be able to pass a constitutional amendment. So they get to promise the moon and continue to like point to abortion as this kind of singular issue that you have to come out and vote on. They see that motivated, activated base around abortion, and they're like, these are easy voters to pick up. And it actually takes until the mid to late 1990s for the Republican Party to really become basically 100% anti-abortion. It's a big issue in the 1990s as they try to work out where they stand on it. But once they get there, they don't move, even though they're not delivering victories, at least not at the national level. They do get a victory with the Casey decision, which creates more space to roll back abortion rights. I think that's in 92. And then they switch their focus to state-level regulations.
Yeah, I remember.
And if you turn
the trap laws were really big. Yes. I remember that a lot.
Yeah, so you see, there's a couple of different waves, but you see in the 80s and 90s with Operation Rescue, you see increased violence against abortion providers. That's when you start to see the murder of doctors who provide abortions and members of their staff, increased attacks on abortion clinics and pregnancy clinics. And then by the 2000s, the focus is all on state laws and changing state laws so that by the time you get to Dobbs, basically there were states in which abortion was access was only theoretical for many of the women.
It's wild. I was talking to my...
It's a bad story.
Terrible. Last spring, I was in North Carolina with some of my friends who all live in Louisville. And we had a really long talk about being a blue dot in a red state and what that feels like and what the benefits are. And they were like, you know, it's ups and downs, but we like where we live. We like this, you know, they love Louisville. Louisville's great. And then Roe v. Wade got overturned, and now we are having different conversations. Like, the, it genuinely scares the absolute shit out of me. And the right seems constantly on the hunt for a boogeyman, on the hunt for the next person who is threatening your children. Right now it's trans people. And it seems to me like I say this on the podcast a lot, they keep narrowing who the bad guy is, who the villain is, because it used to be just like gay people in general, but everyone was like, no, guys, like, this is nothing. But the trans thing is, trans people are such a relatively small population, you know, in this country. Chances are people are not interacting with a lot of trans people in their day-to-day life, but that's the big bet. Or drag queens in libraries, as if that is like this huge threat, when all along the Catholic Church has been abusing children and protecting those abusers. And like, I know you said I can't get caught up on the inconsistencies, but I'm really gonna. What the fuck?
No, I mean, look, Dennis Hastert, who was the longest serving speaker of the House for the Republican Party, molested children. So like, we're looking in the wrong place when we're looking at trans people, but trans people are not being picked on because they are sexually abusive. They are being picked on because they're a sexual minority. And it's fascinating, you know, coming off of the conversation about abortion and reproductive rights, a lot of the same arguments, a lot of the same, sort of strategies to deny access to medical care, to bar access to doctors, to limit what doctors can provide. There are all these bills now, including here in Tennessee, about banning transition care. So there's, you see that same kind of interference in the medical system and in people's personal medical choices. But, you know, it also just kind of coming back to this idea that progress doesn't move in one way, or history doesn't move in one way. It is true that over the past 5 to 10 years, there has been a kind of narrowing, because after the Obergefell decision, after marriage equality became the law of the land, it suddenly wasn't cool to attack gay people. And so then there is this kind of focusing in on trans people, which happens almost immediately. Like, the attacks on drag queens was happening back in 2017, 2018. The sort of turn against trans rights, the bathroom bills are coming out in like 2014, 2015. So all of this stuff was percolating almost immediately. But what we have seen now, you see it in both the Supreme Court and in sort of political rhetoric, is it's broadening back out.
Oh.
That you see more and more people who are saying, we warned you. We said it's a slippery slope. If you have marriage equality, if you give the rights for gays to marry, then you're going to then suddenly, like, then a man can become a woman. Like, you're denying
God's
mm-hmm. reality. And once you've done that, this is what happens. So now we've got to go back and we've got to get rid of gay marriage. We've got to deny gay people the rights to buy websites and cakes and to participate freely in the market. So we're actually seeing more anti-gay rhetoric now than we have seen in quite some time. And so the trans issue then is a kind of entering wedge to the re-mainstreaming of homophobia, and it's pretty dark because it's not just going to be more and more legal restrictions on queer people in the United States, but that type of restriction is almost always accompanied by violence, and we will most likely see more and more of that as well.
Okay. That bummed me out in a really strong way. So I want to go back to talking about Richard Nixon.
Anything else I can bum you out?
No, let's talk shit about Richard Nixon.
Okay. There's plenty of shit to talk.
I don't remember if this was your quote from Slow Burn, and I'm really sorry I keep, like, quoting your stuff back to you like a dork. But I think it was you who said the real question is, like, why did all of these people take these huge risks for a man who is famously disloyal and famously untrustworthy and famously slimy and famously paranoid? Like, and I genuinely have been sitting with that for a year. Like, what... What is happening that this man who has a long history of lying and being corrupt and spying on people, why do these dudes get themselves wrapped up in this?
I think it's the power of the office of the presidency. Yeah. It's just the idea that you're doing it for the president is intoxicating, and you feel kind of untouchable. And in U.S. history, you largely were untouchable. Like, this is the one time that there's a comeuppance, and you don't see many more before or after. So I think that's part of it. Also, Richard Nixon surrounded himself by slimy people, or with slimy people. And so, you know, these were people who wanted power. And supporting the president of the United States was a great way to get it. I mean, you see this, not to bring it back to the present, but, like, you see this with the Trump presidency as well. He surrounded himself with people who
would not only never push back,
but didn't actually believe in a higher set of ideals. Right? They weren't people who were like, oh, I'm fighting for democracy. Oh, I'm fighting for freedom. They were like, I'm going to get mine.
I'm going to get a book deal.
I'm going to get rich. Absolutely. And so that's part of it as well, right? Like, this idea that we can do anything, that we are untouchable, and so we're going to do anything. And if it keeps our person in power, it keeps us in power. And that kind of will to power is a huge part of U.S. politics and why things so often go off the rails. So I think all of that is a big, big part of it. There's some through lines of, like, well, Richard Nixon was trying to win the Vietnam War to keep the Pentagon Papers from coming out. And that, you know, some of his bad acts are really rooted in this idea that the U.S. was doing the right thing and being stymied by Congress and being stymied by popular opinion. But at the end of the day, it just was, he was very powerful. And people in proximity to power do things to stay in power.
And the timing of J. Edgar Hoover's death, almost immediately before Watergate. If J. Edgar Hoover died a decade before or a decade after, what do you think U.S. history would look like?
Wow, it would look a lot. Yeah. It would look a lot different because, you know, he dies a decade sooner than JFK doesn't have and LBJ don't have to deal with J. Edgar Hoover. And I think that gives them a little more breathing room. Martin Luther King Jr. wouldn't have had to deal with J. Edgar Hoover after, like, what, 59 or 60. And so, not to say that, like, some pure-hearted angel would have taken J. Edgar Hoover's place, but his cache of secrets and his use of blackmail and his willingness to strong-arm people and to use all sorts of dirty tricks, the person who followed J. Edgar Hoover didn't have his level of power and wouldn't have had his level of power if he had died 10 years earlier. And 10 years later, 10 years later is a really interesting question, because I'm not sure how Watergate plays out if J. Edgar Hoover is still in
power. Do you think it happens?
Because the Deep Throat.
Do you think the break-in happens?
I mean, I think the break-in happens. The revelation is what I'm curious about. Because, you know, Deep Throat was a member of the FBI, and it was part of an internal jockeying for power. And I have to go back and look at this, but Mark Felt, who was Deep Throat, had been passed over for a promotion, and that was part of what fueled his revenge. And I think that that probably doesn't take place if Hoover isn't dead. So how much we would have known about Watergate might have looked a little different. And maybe Hoover could have, like,
made it go away.
Maybe not made it go away, but, you know, kept Richard Nixon from the Saturday Night Massacre and some of the other, like, kind of out of control acts that were happening in the waning days of Watergate.
Wow. That
it's a great counterfactual. It's such an interesting question.
It's just, I don't know. The things that people can get away with and do just by sheer force of will. Like, sometimes I just think about how many huge events in the 20th century were facilitated by, like, one dude and his ego or his thirst for power or whatever. Like, Oppenheimer, J. Edgar Hoover, Trump. Like, there's so many people who just want to create their own little world so they can control things. And those are the people who created the bomb.
It's not good. I don't think that banning men would end all of this, but I mean, it would be the
worst. No, this is the first time it wasn't me suggesting a time to ban men, so I'm pretty excited to dig into this here.
Really happy that I could float the
idea. Love that. I wanted to, while we're talking about about Watergate,
about banning men,
we're going to talk about Sam Ervin, who first of all, the first time I heard him say, well, I'm just a country lawyer, I thought that was a joke from Futurama that they made up, and the lawyer was a chicken. It was a good joke. I did not know it was a real human being who said, no, I'm just a simple country lawyer, which is a wild thing for an adult to say.
It's an incredible thing to say, and it's just, like, so much of, like, the politics of the mid-20th century are so
hokey, so cheesy,
like, corny,
so cheesy. Now, he oversaw the hearing, the Watergate hearing, and became this sort of liberal hero, which is an interesting rewrite of history, I would say. So why did people glom onto him? Why was he so liked?
Because he was seen as kind of the avatar of the people who were holding Richard Nixon accountable. This idea that somebody was finally holding him accountable. Somebody was doing something. We see this with Liz Cheney.
Oh, sure. Right?
Like, the idea that you're, like, standing up to a powerful person and willing to risk something in order to do so is something that I think people are attracted to. It does also get at this very common habit in U.S. politics to try to find a hero and to then forgive or forget all of the bad acts that person that you're elevating has been involved with. And we see that time and again in American politics, too. But especially when you have, you know, a president who is accused of particularly bad acts, when you have somebody come forward. I mean, this was part of the fervor behind Olimania in the 1980s and in Iran-Contra, that there were a lot of liberals who believed that Oliver North was going to make it clear that Ronald Reagan had engaged in all of these illegal acts, and he was going to be the hero for exposing Ronald Reagan. Now, that's not how things played out. North does not stay a liberal hero very long. But I think that dynamic is similar.
So people started making T-shirts, called him Uncle Sam. But could you speak a little bit to his past?
So this is something that I'm not super brushed up on at the moment, but wasn't like, he like he
a was full on segregationist? Like, yeah, 100%.
But this is the thing too, right? Like he like one of the reasons that he's the head of this committee is because white Southern Democrats were the people with any sort of longevity, seniority in the Democratic Party. When you talk about the party switching, you had plenty of white segregationists who remain part of the Democratic Party well into the 70s, 80s, 90s. And because some of these guys don't die until like 2010, all the way into like the Obama administration. So these folks stick around, and because of the seniority, they have these very high-powered positions within the Democratic Party. And so you have these kind of lions of the Senate during this very liberal era in the Democratic Party who are, in fact, if not currently arch-segregationists, that had been their politics. That had been where the Democratic Party had come from, and so many of these senior senators, so many of these people who emerge during something like Watergate, during the Church Committee hearings, are people who are very, very conservative when it comes to racial politics. They're very anti-Black, and they have this long history of anti-Black politics. Not to say that people can't change, but there wasn't a lot of repenting going on after the Civil Rights Act. So you end up just, again, like lionizing people with pretty awful pasts.
So why were like Vietnam protesters such a perceived threat? I feel like a lot of like Nixon's paranoia was like all these kids are protesting across campuses, but like if they had power, they wouldn't be protesting. Like it just kind of is confusing to me that what he would let his focus get drawn into. 'Cause to me, student protesting is, I mean, I know really the mid-20th century Vietnam was like the rise of the sort of the protesting, you know, colleges are liberal, et cetera. But it escalates to fucking Kent State. Like, how did this, why are protesters such a threat or a perceived threat?
I think it's important to write a perceived threat. Well, and it's something that Ronald Reagan, as governor of California, makes a lot of hay and gets a lot of political capital for attacking the student protesters. And Nixon is watching and learning from that. So part of it is a question of politics. But I think the kind of broader story is the way that power and respect were expected to work in the United States was beginning to change. Which is not to say that these student protesters had very much power, but you just had real victories in the Black civil rights movement. People who had been at the bottom of the social and racial and economic and political hierarchy had managed to get what they wanted out of a Democratic president. Here you have these largely white students who are protesting the war, who are resisting getting involved in the war, and who are influencing U.S. policy. You see the draft begin to change. You see more and more people being excluded from the draft. You see the Vietnamization of the war, in part because there are all of these protests. And now the policy has to change because the draft is causing so much political unrest in the United States. And you have protests, anti-war protesters clashing with police outside of the Democratic Convention in 1968. It's not just staying contained to college campuses. And it is also seen as a signal to both the Soviet Union and to the North Vietnamese that the United States is not united, that the war is divisive, and that the war is actually causing U.S. politics to begin to crumble. And young people who were supposed to understand their place in the hierarchy are now challenging presidents. That wasn't supposed to happen. There was a much more rigidly hierarchical deference to power in the 1940s and 1950s, particularly among the white middle class in the United States. And one of the big changes of the 1960s is that that deference to power and tradition begins to break down, not across the board, not always in lasting ways, but that rejection of authority becomes cool. And coolness is actually a really powerful political force that Richard Nixon has a real difficult time with.
He's a deeply, deeply uncool gentleman, isn't he?
extremely uncool and yet really interested in getting cool sure. points. So he like appears on the Laughing television sketch show. He hangs out with the Rat Pack, right? He hangs out with Elvis Presley. Like he likes celebrity. Yeah. He wants to be cool. And these kids actually are.
You guys talk a lot on your podcast about whether things are inevitable or not. And it like, another thing that sort of like made my brain soup for a little while, especially around the Civil War. Like there's Dr. Carter Jackson talks a lot about like it mm-hmm. felt inevitable, but in the same way that Slow Burn is framed of people who were living through Watergate did not know how it was going to end.
Yeah.
I don't know where I was going with that. I think I just was thinking out loud.
No, I mean, this idea of trying to recover contingency mm. as a force in history is really important mm-hmm. Because there are all these moments where you can't quite understand why people are acting the way that they were, because you're like, well, but the war is going to end in like 5 years, or the war is going to start mm-hmm. in 5 years, or the Great Depression mm-hmm. is going to come, or the Great Depression is about to end. And there's this sense that like people in the past had the same perfect knowledge of what was going to mm-hmm. happen next. And it really acts as a damper on one of the most important tools in a historian's toolbox, which is historical empathy. Mm. The ability to like put yourself in the shoes of the person at the time. And in order to do that, you have to suspend your knowledge of what comes next and sort of embody the emotions a person would be feeling. Let's say in 1968, if you're on a college campus and you know you could get drafted, and this war could go on forever. And actually, this war could become a nuclear war, because actually Goldwater, when he was running for president, thought about using conventional tactical nukes. Not a thing. but, you know, that the world seems to be spinning off its axis, and you don't know that it's not going to spin off its axis, that anything could happen. That idea of contingency is so important for understanding history.
I remember I had a high school history teacher, and I was a freshman in high school during the 2000 election, and I remember him saying, when people study history, they are going to think that all anybody was doing for this week or month or however long into it we were was just being a part of that and dealing with that. But he's like, no, you're in my history class. You've got a test tomorrow. Like, and it was a really impactful thing that he said of like, it, just people going through life while this weird shit happens in the background.
Yeah. I mean, in the middle of World War II, people still had to go to the grocery, something that was obviously inflected by the war itself. They had sent their kids to school. They had to clean the house. Like all of those very ordinary, mundane things would have been inflected by the war. But they would, like, people would have just been living their lives.
Y'all did that series about American Girl dolls, which I loved because I was the exact right age for it, because you said you were a little too old for it. I was a Felicity girl, obviously. She liked horse girls. but somebody mentioned the Molly character gave that sort of thing of like, yeah, her dad is away at war, and in World War II was sort of this overarching thing, but she was trying to get in the pageant and she wants to do that. Like she was still just living her little 12-year-old life.
Which is kind of the brilliance of that series, right? I think that there's always the sort of top line description of who the dolls are. Oh, this is the internment doll, or this is the slavery doll, or this is the World War II doll. But if you actually get into the stories that they tell in the books, which again, I was a little too old for them, but in researching them, this idea that they were just little girls is actually really powerful and really important.
Yeah, I really, really, really enjoyed the episode discussing Addie, because I was the target for that. There was a lot of discussion of Addie was a black doll for white girls, to sort of sum it up, and that's me. Like, that's how I learned. I was the white girl. Like, and it worked. I learned empathy, and I learned about slavery, and I learned what it looked, and it worked. It just took me until I was in my late 30s to realize, like, oh, yeah, but maybe I shouldn't have been the target audience for for a little...
Maybe there should have been a black doll that black girls really wanted to play with.
But of course, you know, I, in hindsight, all of that stuff, it felt really progressive at the time to have a black doll. It was just the whole... Such wild thing.
But I actually... So Aisha Harris was our guest on that show, and she's amazing. She has this wonderful new book that has all of these pop culture essays in it, including her essays about the American Girl dolls. I think here, too, like, historical empathy is important. The conversation has moved on. There's a way to look at the decisions that we made and the opinions that we held and say, hey, I didn't... There were things that I wish that I would have known at that time, and the information was available to me at that time. Like, you know, maybe I could have learned more and engaged with more people and asked more questions. But, okay, that's what you knew and what you did at the time. Now you know different things, and that's great. Don't be too hard on
and
yourself.
It's a sign of growth, right? Like, everything we did when we were 10 was so cringy. Things I did when I was 25, also cringy in, you know, the 2023 lens of
things.
Things
I did last week are cringy.
I mean, listen, I'm going to be cringing over things from this very interview for the rut. No, I'm kidding. I think it's been fine. But I don't know. It's just a, just an interesting thing. Okay. Last thing. Oh, okay. I had two more things. Do we want to talk about Newt Gingrich or Project Paperclip?
Let's do Gingrich.
Great.
More solidly in my wheelhouse.
Also, I don't think we need more Nazi content today.
I can always come back to give you more Nazi we'll content, because like, we haven't even touched on recent Nazis.
Yeah. Oh, my God. Okay. So I listened to The Last Archive, which is a podcast about, like, how we know what is true. And they did a whole episode about Newt Gingrich made these, like, cassette tapes and mailed them out. And I would love to hear you discuss that and, like, the homogeny of conservatives. Could you kind of spin off on that a little bit?
Sure. Look, Newt Gingrich, Newt Gingrich was a history PhD.
He's
who
a doctor?
Was working in Georgia. PhD.
Huh.
Yeah. Doctor
I'm
of history.
Really mad that that's true.
He had been a professor, and in fact, his first year as a professor, the presidency of the college became open, and he applied for it, which kind of gives you a sense of Newt Gingrich's personality and sense of his own importance. And instead, what ended up happening was he ran for Congress. And in 1979, he enters Congress as a backbencher in the Republican Party, and... Because he has this kind of sense of importance, he sets out a plan to make the Republicans the majority and to become Speaker of the House, which was a wild thing to think in the late 1970s, because Republicans had been out of power for decades at that point, and there wasn't any sort of clear path back for them. Part of what he does is he's like, we have to discipline the Republican Party and the members of the Republican Party in how they attack Democrats, how they speak, the kinds of promises they make, what their agenda looks like, in order to make it politically palatable and to encourage Americans to vote for them. And that's exactly what he sets out to do. He helps to lead one of these organizations called GOP PAC, GOPAC, which puts a lot of money into races, into training candidates. This is where those tapes come in. He is somebody who is very confrontational, and he has a very specific way of speaking, and his word choice is very deliberate. He draws up this memo that's like, these are the words that we should associate with Democrats, and they're all like, disgusting, profligate, corrupt. And here are the words that we should use when we talk about Republicans. Future-looking visionaries.
Is this when they got the
dreamers
corner on values and family and all of those words that are, like, coded for conservative?
Exactly at this moment. He's a big part of that. And he sends out these tapes to train candidates to talk the way that he does. And back in the day when people are like, when you're campaigning, you're in the car all the time, so you can listen to these tapes. And that's how he spreads his message. That's how you start to get this homogeneity in the way that Republicans talk as they listen to his
message. How did he become so prolific? Like, why are people listening to this freshman congressman?
he gets reelected several times, which helps a lot. So he starts to like move up in the ranks a little bit. He is a very good salesman of himself. He helps to found all of these organizations that make him more prominent. So like the Conservative Opportunity Society, he begins to organize conservatives within the Republican caucus. At the time, the Republican Party is more ideologically diverse. So that's one way. He begins to corner the market on conservatives, which is a big part of his appeal. And then as he's like climbing up the ranks, he begins to target the people above him to take them out. So one of his first targets is Jim Wright, who's the Democratic leader in the House, the speaker. He finds ethics complaints to bring up against Wright. And actually, Wright ends up resigning because of this campaign that Gingrich carries out against him.
Were they legit ethics complaints?
They were somewhat legit. I mean, are they necessarily, like, they wouldn't be scandalous today.
Got it.
Yeah, what is. But at the time, like, it was, ethics was a big thing. So he weaponizes ethics in order to take out his competition. And he goes after some high-level Republicans as well. He makes his way up very quickly up the Republican leadership and positions himself to become Speaker when Republicans do take over the majority. What is interesting about that, one, is that he succeeds. He used the contract with America in order to unify a national agenda. He becomes Speaker in 1995. He's forced out not that long after, three or four years later, because of ethics violations.
Really?
Hoisted on his own petard.
What violations?
So his violation was he was making a ton of money on the side for book deals. He had this like kind of college course. He had a couple of television shows on this not very long-lived conservative satellite network called National Empowerment Television. And one of his things was like this video college course that he was running, and that he was maybe misrepresenting the money that he got or misfiling his taxes. He was just like
shady business dude.
There was shady business, and he actually, like, he gets fined something like $300,000 while he is Speaker of the House for these ethics violations. And then when the Republicans do very, very, very poorly in the 1998 midterms, in the middle of impeachment, then they're just like, we are done with you. He resigns. He leaves the House. So he's not in power that long, maybe like 4 years.
Why was his goal Speaker of the House? Like, I know he ran for president later, but why? It seems like if you're going to set your sights to something absurdly high, like Speaker of the House, president feels.
But Speaker of the House is a lot of power within Congress, right? It was the highest position he could reach as a member of Congress. And it was something that no Republican had done in like 50 years. And so it really would have been a sea change. He also wanted to revamp the speaker position and position it as somebody who was on level with the president. He wanted people to think that the opposite of Bill Clinton was Newt Gingrich. And positioned himself that way really effectively. So he was building his way up to an eventual presidential run that obviously gets short-circuited by everything going haywire later. But that was kind of his idea, that he would be the shadow president or the opposition president as Speaker of the House.
Huh. Wow.
It's not a great plan, but it does elevate him into a household
name.
No,
it's not a great plan, and it just feels so... And this is obviously you relaying the story. It doesn't feel like he's a person who's like, I want to become speaker so I can help people. I want to become speaker so I can. It's just he wants the power.
Yes, he did not have. I mean, yes, he had things that he wanted to do. He's a big science nerd. And so there were actually like all of these like very fanciful scientific things he wanted to do. But also like he had very conservative politics that he wanted to promote. At the same time, that's not why he wanted to become speaker. He wanted to become speaker because there was so much power imbued in it. And nowadays, we don't necessarily think about the speaker as a really powerful role. Although Nancy Pelosi exercises a tremendous amount of power as speaker, and I think is often overlooked in part because she's a woman in that position, and so not heralded as much as she might otherwise be. But, you know, on the Republican side, the speaker has become a puppet figure in many ways. Like Kevin McCarthy has very little power within the house.
I forgot he was speaker actually.
Yeah, and Paul Ryan before him like leaves very quickly.
The whole Kevin McCarthy election debacle. Those were fun days. Oh,
it was. I mean, even though it was kind of clear where it was going to end,
I enjoyed every push alert I got. I was like, failed again. And I was like,
you're like, I realize you're going to become speaker, and that's what you want. But the humiliation along the way,
we need to cling to those.
Just a little something for us, a little treat for us.
Oh, I just love when they. The moments of Schadenfreude are like what I think got us through the last 5-10 years. Like the Four Seasons incident.
I think that's right.
Like the Four Seasons incident was just
the hair dye running.
It was like an episode of Veep. Like I've just
I feel like that was such a cathartic moment in a lot of ways. And yet, of course, what is happening is a slow-rolling coup that would become a fast-rolling coup a couple of weeks later. And that has been the part of the surrealness of the past 6 or 7 years, but also just kind of what fascism and illiberalism look like, is that it's not necessarily like people in threatening uniforms using power and violence in very clear ways. Sometimes it is also like these bungling idiots who are also attacking democracy and sometimes more effectively than others. But it's like this very serious and awful thing is happening. And then it's like wrapped in all of this absurdity, which I think has become a real feature of our politics of late.
I'm sorry. I think I had another point, but I think we should wrap it up. This is such a pleasure. I'm so happy right now. I want to just hang out with you and have a glass of wine and talk shit about Reagan.
Next time we'll do Friendly Atheist After Dark. We'll have our glasses of wine and we will continue the conversation.
Absolutely. Dr. Hemmer, this was a privilege and a joy for me. Thank you for your time. Thank you for letting me bug you until we got this time in. I'm just such a fan of your. I remember the first time I was watching, the first time I was watching Slow Burn. I'm so cool. I heard your voice and I was like, is that like a friend of mine? I was like, it's Nikki.
I love that. Well, this has been such a pleasure. Thank you so much for having me. And let's do it again.
This was great. Do you want to plug anything? Your shows are...
Sure. My podcasts are This Day in Esoteric Political History, which is with the Radiotopia Network. I also do an independent podcast called Past Present that comes out every week, another just kind of like discussion of history. I have a book that came out last year around this time called Partisans. So if you're interested in the right in the 1990s, that is a good place to go. If you want to see how things went off the rails in the 1990s, that's a good source. I write a column for CNN. I'm out and about on the various social medias, so you can find me there chatting about whatever is going on
Excellent.
In the world.
Dr. Hemmer, thank you so much for your time. I hope we get to speak soon. If I run over in Nashville, I'm gonna look you up and show up at your house like, it's me.
Please do.
Thank you for your time. I hope you have a great rest of your week, and take care. We'll speak soon, I hope.
All right, sounds good. Thanks so much.